At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Today on the broadcast, we bid the sequester a fond farewell. Our philanthropy series and why big donors give. Also, meat. Lots and lots of meat. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit listener-supported service. To keep our coverage strong and relevant, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount helps us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 12th of December. Good, as always, to have you with us. You know how people have been saying the congressional budget deal worked out earlier this week was baby steps? Well, this afternoon, the House took a big step forward and passed the thing. Next stop, the Senate, then in all probability, the president's desk, assuming it passes. This agreement is not, as you've heard, the be-all and end-all of budget deals. There is a lot that's not in it. What it does do, though, is takes most of the sting out of the sequester, the automatic budget cuts from earlier this year, the second round of which was supposed to start next month. So, to get us going today, Marketplace's David Gura has this sequestration postmortem.
Let's start with the vitals. Sequestration came to life on March 1st with spending cuts to the tune of $85 billion. Bruce Kane is a political science professor at Stanford, and he says the sequester was designed to be unappealing to lawmakers in both parties.
The idea was that that would be so unpalatable that eventually they would come to the table.
But that took a while. Programs were exempt. Congress passed exceptions for air traffic controllers and FBI agents. So for many Americans, Kane says, that first round of cuts seemed abstract.
It didn't ripple out to the public in the same way that, say, cuts at the local government level and the state level do.
Because of how this has played out, Eric Heberlig wonders if we'll see more sequesters. He's a poli-sci professor at UNC Charlotte.
Because people say, well, this is a way to reduce spending. The economy didn't collapse, so what's the big deal?
The fear of more cuts next year is what finally got negotiators to compromise. But here's the thing. It's too soon to do a postmortem, says Alice Rivlin with the Brookings Institution.
The sequester is not dead.
Paul Ryan and Patty Murray's deal is just a partial replacement for only two of the sequester's remaining 8 years.
This sequester is still moving. It's still alive.
Paul Light's a professor of public service at NYU.
This is going to come up over and over again.
By law, until fiscal year 2021. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
You can file this next one under the broad category of you are what you eat. The Food and Drug Administration is out with some new rules about antibiotics. Antibiotics for livestock and poultry specifically. The FDA wants to reduce drug use in the raising of those animals and so cut the risk of drug-resistant bacteria in people. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has the economics of the whole thing.
Farm animals are big drug users. Stuart Levy is a professor at Tufts University and president of the Alliance for the Prudent Use of Antibiotics.
70% of all antibiotics produced in this country, by weight, go to animals.
And he says almost all of those are feed additives.
Do we need all this antibiotic usage? The answer is no.
The FDA agrees. No more using antibiotics to fatten animals. It's asking drug companies to voluntarily change their labels, technically restricting use by farmers, and potentially raising their costs. Gay Miller is a professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She says farmers want one thing, to
produce a pig that is healthy and high quality as efficiently as possible.
A decade ago, she estimated removing antibiotics to encourage growth might cost farmers a little more than a buck a pig.
Certainly is not something that makes the price of meat go down, that's for sure.
Scott Hurd's a professor at Iowa State University and former USDA Deputy Undersecretary for Food Safety. He says the ag industry is ready for the change, but the rules aren't going to stop farmers from giving drugs to their animals to keep them healthy.
We're raising babies here, and so the important thing about antibiotics is it helps people to raise those babies in a healthy way.
The pharma companies don't seem all that worried. They're about to lose a big customer. David Krimpa is an analyst at Morningstar.
We think the implications will be pretty minor, at least in the near term.
He thinks without a tougher ban, farmers are going to keep doing what they do. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
They tried and tried today and then tried some more, but traders couldn't keep the major indices above water. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. No offense intended to Texas or Oklahoma, but the center of the American oil industry nowadays is pretty much out in western North Dakota. Tens of thousands of workers have flooded the small towns out there. And for local services like healthcare, the dangerous conditions and long hours of oil field life have brought lots and lots of business. Independent producer Todd Melby's got a series going on about the North Dakota oil fields. He calls it Black Gold Boom. And today, the director of the ambulance service in Killdeer, North Dakota, a dot on the map that counted 751 people in the last census.
Okay, my name's Ann Hafner. We're at Killdeer Area Ambulance Service in Killdeer, North Dakota.
Yeah, if you wanted a changing ambulance service, you found it.
Any kind of trauma you can think of. People fall off of things, people get crushed by things, people get hit by things, things blow up. What I find the most exciting are the medical conditions related to the oil. We have people from out of state who have been healthy all their lives who come up here and work like they're 20 years younger than they are, and their hearts can't take it. And you know, a lot of these guys work longer hours straight with less sleep than they ever have before. And they have to drive some of them quite a distance to get back to where they're sleeping. So, you know, you add a 2-hour drive a day on top of working for 12 hours in the heat like you're not used to doing. If you ever had any inclination to high blood pressure, you're going to have it now. And then we have the various and sundry strange injuries that you only see in the EMT books. Strange equipment that we're not familiar with, that we haven't worked with, that explodes and you're not sure about where all the parts went, or high-pressure equipment. The falls are unbelievable, the number of falls we have. We know what we have to do on a well site, and that's pretty much what we pay attention to. I haven't learned all the equipment yet. I want to know how far they fell, what hit them, and how long ago was it. Those are the things we need to know, and if we're safe to get out, sometimes we're not even safe to get out of the ambulance.
Kilder ambulance, west on Fire Carver. Please respond to a semi-rollover, possibly an oil tanker.
Yeah, can you meet Aaron at the bay and bring 6-7? He's on his way back from Manning. Okay, thank you.
Todd's series, Black Gold Boom, is an initiative of Prairie Public Broadcasting and the Association of Independents in Radio. Jeff Bezos, the CEO of Amazon, got a nifty amount of coverage a couple of weeks ago when he talked about delivering packages by way of drones. Remember that? After the initial buzz, a lot of people dismissed that idea as kind of pie in the sky. But out in southwest Ohio, it sounds like money in the bank. Right now, Dayton and its suburbs are in the running to become a federal testing range for commercial drones. From WYSO, Lewis Wallace has the story.
California has Silicon Valley. Southwest Ohio's hoping to become Drone Valley. Above the cornfields and strip malls, you'd see tiny helicopters and planes taking to the skies to do all kinds of things.
Disaster management, power line surveys, telecommunications, weather monitoring.
Frank Biafor runs Selectech Geospatial, a small high-tech manufacturer near Dayton.
Making movies, sporting events, environmental monitoring, oil and gas.
He says exploration. Some of these uses for unmanned aerial vehicles, UAV is the industry term for drones, are only a couple years out. We're in the company hangar at Springfield Air Park. Biafor shows off a UAV that looks sort of like an insect with four helicopter blades and four spindly legs. It lifts off smoothly from the warehouse floor. The drone passes over our heads, creating a little breeze and hovering in midair like a bird in the wind.
The economic benefit is really only limited by our imagination.
That's Maurice McDonald with the Dayton Development Coalition. Ohio expects to bring in more than $2 billion from drones by 2025. People here would be building them and testing them. This area could use the boost. It's been battered by the loss of manufacturing jobs. But there's a hang-up.
Well, the FAA really needs to address the procedures and policies associated with flying these systems.
Flying these systems, pretty important. Right now, most companies can't actually do that because the Federal Aviation Administration hasn't decided how to regulate them yet. The agency is going to pick six sites to open up airspace where companies can test UAVs. The hope is companies will come to places like Springfield for the airspace and then stay for good. But not everyone around here wants commercial drones to rule the skies. Take this non-scientific survey of shoppers at the Springfield Mall. Would they want their pizza delivered by drones?
Saves money on tips, like for the pizza guys.
Anything's possible, but it's not going to happen anytime soon.
I'd be excited. Pizza delivered by a drone, I'd probably order them three a day.
I don't like it when machines take over. That would be very weird.
Yes, the weird factor. As UAVs get smaller and cheaper, people are worried about privacy, which is one of the reasons the FAA is taking its time on regulations.
Well, I certainly don't want him flying over my house.
That's Frank Biafor again. Standing in his hangar full of model drones, he wants to be clear. Surveillance is not what his UAVs are about. The first uses will probably be agricultural, checking crops for mold or standing water. And what's a few candid pics of Ohio's cornfields?
The corn doesn't care.
The FAA decision on where to let drones test their wings and their cameras and their high-tech sensors could come out as soon as this week. Ohio's in the running against 23 states, including North Dakota, Wyoming, New York, and California. In Springfield, Ohio, I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
Those drones are pretty cool, actually. Better seen than heard. So we've got video of one of the ones being tested in Ohio up on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up.
Per capita, Americans eat about 225 pounds of meat a year. Given that that's an average, that means somebody is eating a lot of meat.
So medium rare on that burger, I guess, huh? But first, let's do the numbers. Here we go. Three in a row, I think. The Dow Industrial's off 104 points today, 2/3%, ended at 15,739. The NASDAQ edged down 5 points, about a 10%, finished at 3998. The S&P 500 down 6 points, about a 1/3% is there, to wrap up at 1775. Cisco Systems unplugged 1.75% today. Ciena lost 7%. Both of those companies make computer networking equipment and both lower their revenue forecasts. Oracle down 3% today after an analyst downgrade. Facebook, however, posted a 5% gain. Bond prices, well, they fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose 2.88%. And you are listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is listener-supported. To keep our coverage relevant and compelling, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount supports your daily dose of business insight from Marketplace. So please help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday the 13th. Yep, I said it out loud. Friday the 13th.
Those afflicted with triskaidekaphobia, fear of the number 13, may seek shelter from bad luck. Think positive thoughts, people. The Labor Department issues its monthly producer price index for November. And happy birthday to actor Steve Buscemi. He turns 56 while the rest of us wait for the next season of Boardwalk Empire. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Instagram, the social media photo sharing site, introduced a new feature today. It's called Instagram Direct. It lets you share your selfies privately instead of just laying them out there for everybody to see, which is a nice feature, I suppose. But Sally Herships explains it's not really about the pictures.
If you're wondering if Instagram's new private feature was motivated by concerns about privacy, not so much. That's according to Brian Blau with Gartner, a technology research firm.
I really believe that this new feature that Instagram has released is about competition.
Blau says, remember, Facebook, which owns Instagram, tried to buy Snapchat, a photo and messaging service, but no deal. So if you can't buy them, copy their features so your users don't leave. Though Blau says that strategy could cause problems.
They're all starting to look the same. You know, these services are really starting to be homogenous, starting to look like one big pile of goop.
What's happening now is there's a lot of applications that want to become platforms.
Julie Osk is a principal analyst with Forrester Research.
They want to become that interface between the consumer and the phone that does all things.
And in order to get there, Osk says companies are willing to take some risks, like offering similar features. After all, the rewards can be enormous. While Instagram has 80 million users, Osk points to WeChat, an app popular in Asia, with hundreds of millions of users. It's become a platform.
I used WeChat in Beijing a month ago, and we ordered takeout food from a micro app within WeChat.
Osk says the U.S. needs to catch up with the global market. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Maybe you've donated to the Red Cross this year or sponsored a friend walking to end breast cancer, some kind of philanthropy. Our series this week, A Lot to Give, has gone to the upper reaches of charity, donors who give a lot of money, maybe millions, for their particular cause. But why do they do that? Why do they give so much? From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Noelle King wraps up our series with the motives behind big giving.
Like many colleges across the country, the campus of the University of Southern California is a testament to big donors. I piled into a golf cart with Hannah Herr, a senior who gives campus tours. We got started at
the Locher Track and Field Stadium,
named for former USC trustee Catherine Locher, who donated more than $3 million to build it.
It's also the practice location of the USC marching band, the Spirit of Troy. They're the self-declared greatest marching band in the history of the universe.
Then it's on to the new Engelman Student Health Center, named for USC alum Michelle Dado Engelman and her husband Roger, who donated $15 million. In some places, there are names on names.
Oh, the Kenneth T. Norris Dental Science Center. Even the Dental Science Center is...
It's part of the Austria School of Dentistry.
USC gets plenty of anonymous donations, but the donors who do put their names on buildings, are they doing it for credit?
I have a friend who calls it the edifice complex.
That's Jennifer McCray. She's a fundraiser and a senior research fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School. She says, sure, sometimes recognition and peer pressure do entice people to give, at least initially.
People often enter philanthropy from a very social perspective. This is kind of the world of galas and special events and, you know, putting your name on a building. And to a certain extent, that's fine.
Right now, this is just a boarded-off construction site on New York's west side. But in 3 years, it'll be Columbia University Medical Center's new graduate education building, a soaring glass tower with cutting-edge equipment and technology named for Dr. Roy Vagelos and his wife, Diana. They donated $50 million. I asked Dr. Vagelos whether having his name on the building is important to him, and he looked a little exasperated.
Names don't mean a hell of a lot to me. The fact that the students at Columbia will have the best facilities probably in the world for their education is important to me.
because 60 years ago, he was a scholarship kid at Columbia's medical school. His parents were Greek immigrants who owned a restaurant in New Jersey.
Our little restaurant specialized in homemade ice cream and candies. That went down the tubes at the time of the stock market crash. By the way, I was born in October of 1929.
After Columbia, he rose to become the CEO of the multinational pharmaceutical company Merck. A lot of big donors talk like Dr. Vagelos. They say they give to things they really care about. Really? Well, fundraisers say it's often true. Remember Jennifer McCrae? Her first job out of college was raising money for her alma mater's new science building.
I just started calling on alumni and parents and friends of the college. It was 1988, so I had a briefcase, like one of those hard briefcases full of blueprints, and would sit down in their office and pull out the blueprint and say, your name goes here. And I was having no luck.
Then one day, she had an epiphany. She stopped pitching your name goes here and instead told potential donors what the science building would mean for the college. It worked. Like anything involving money and human behavior, there are shades of gray here. Jen Shang is a professor of philanthropic psychology at Indiana University. She says giving to get recognition can be almost entirely unselfish.
People want credits for different reasons. So, for example, someone like Bill Gates, like everybody knows that Bill Gates tell people when he does something. The motive for that, at least being publicly perceived, is that he wants to encourage other people to do the same thing.
And people who donate anonymously aren't necessarily modest.
You know, sometimes they say the reason I don't want to be named is because I don't want to be asked by way more people than I'm already asked already.
Back in the golf cart at the end of my tour of USC, Hannah Herr tells me she's already got a job lined up for after she graduates at Goldman Sachs. So will she donate to her alma mater someday?
Definitely. I actually was just telling my mom the other day that in the future, when I start to be financially independent and I'm able to, you know, have some spare income basically to donate back to USC, I definitely plan to.
I can almost see her surname carved into a theater or a lecture hall. Her, spelled H-U-R-R. But she has another idea.
I'm a big fan of puns. I thought it'd be funny to have a Her scholarship for women who want to enter management and business.
Which, Hannah says, is something she really cares about. And having the scholarship named after her? Well, it wouldn't hurt. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
The rest of our series, A Lot to Give, is on our website. Interviews, feature stories, and a game as well. We call it Who Gives? See what famous philanthropist you give like. It's at marketplace.org. As a segue of sorts from Adrian's story about livestock and antibiotics up at the top of the program, consider this for a second. Americans eat a little bit more than 50 billion pounds of meat a year. Getting our hands on all that beef, pork, and chicken is a delicate balancing act of consumer demand, resource utilization, and agriculture policy, to name just three, really. Maureen Ogle is the author of a new book about that balance. It's called In Meat We Trust. Maureen, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I read something about you as I was preparing for this interview. You describe yourself as a former vegetarian.
I did not eat meat for about 25 years. I'm old, people. And for political reasons, I just stopped eating meat. And yeah. I still eat for the purpose when I knew I was going to get asked questions like that. So I actually kept track of how much meat I ate for the course of a year. And I only eat about 25 pounds of meat a year. On average, per capita, Americans eat about 225 pounds.
Wow. So that's astounding.
I know. I got to tell you, honestly, given that that's an average, that means somebody is eating a lot of meat.
One of the other really interesting points that you make in this book is meat and the cheap supply, relatively cheap supply thereof, is a key part of the entire consumer economy in this country.
Well, it is. I honestly didn't know a thing about this when I started writing the book, because I prefer to write about things I don't know anything about because I don't have an agenda. And what I found was that as Americans moved from farm to town, a fact we now absolutely take for granted because the overwhelming majority of us live in an urban place, farmers struggled to try to provide food to consumers who demanded that that food be as low cost as possible. And from that has come this extraordinary infrastructure, not just for livestock production, but crop production and also processing and the logistics of delivery and manufacture.
And we work our way up to the point where present day we have systematized the production of meat in this country to a fare thee well.
Yes, we have. And there are two points to make about that. One is that the system that we have, which, as I'm sure you and your audience know, is under a great deal of criticism now, it's been specifically designed over many, many decades by family farmers to meet enormous demand. That's the operative factor here. Demand is what drives the system. But the other piece of this puzzle that I think a lot of critics don't take into account is that this system, since the colonial period, has been built to supply meat to the rest of the world. Even during the colonial period, colonists were shipping meatstuffs out around the globe, and we still do that today.
Yeah. But I'm gonna trot out the S word here now and ask you about sustainability, right? I mean, can we keep on going producing meat cheaply enough to feed our population in a way that won't be really bad for the planet and the rest of the economy?
Well, and here's where I'm going to get myself in trouble with probably 99.9% of the people who are listening.
I do it every day. Don't worry about
it. This is my take based on 7 years of working on this book. That's how long it took me. The system we have now has many flaws. I wouldn't want to live next to a hog confinement operation, and I'm pretty sure you wouldn't either. But the simple fact is, given the demand, the system we have is the least disruptive we can have. It's the least disruptive to the soil. It's the least disruptive to people. It's the least disruptive to the environment. It's not perfect, but the idea of doing what critics want us to do, which is to dismantle the existing system and then go back to small-scale agricultural production, we can't do that and supply demand.
The book is called In Meat We Trust by Maureen Ogle. The subtitle is An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. Maureen, thanks very much for your time.
Kai, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today in which we pause to give thanks for the U.S. Department of Transportation. The Federal Communications Commission voted 3-2 today to have a look at whether cell phones ought to be allowed on airplanes. We have known that's been coming for a while now. It's not news. The head of the FCC said today that even if they do approve cell phone use, it'll be up to individual airlines as to whether or not they will allow them. But here is where the Department of Transportation rides to the rescue. Secretary Anthony Fox came in today and said his department will have the final say on cell phones on airplanes in this country. Thank you very much. So there's hope yet. All right, that's it. We are done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off another 104 points, 2/3 of 1%. The NASDAQ down 5 points, about a 10%. The S&P 500 down 6 points, 1/3 of 1%. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.